College leaders everywhere are facing challenging decisions in this modern era.
Have we got a stadium?
Yes.
Have we got a college?
Yes.
Or we can't support both. Tomorrow we start tearing down the college.
And decisions on the geographical makeup of the rebuilding Pac-12 haven't been easy either.
Las Vegas, Nevada.
That's how I got to Memphis.
New Orleans.
UTSA, anyone?
Anybody going to San Antonio?
How about GCU?
Phoenix, Arizona.
Moraga?
The bells of St. Mary's.
However the geography ultimately looks, it's great to know the Pac-12 is coming back. And as it does, and when it does, the Joe Beaver Show will be along for the ride, striking that hopeful note.
These are
yourselves, amigos.
Now, the Joe Beaver Show on 1240 Joe Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome in. Mike Parker with John Warren, and we want... I had a chance, Johnny. I had the chance. The chance, did you get a chance? Yes. Chance, did you read... Did you get a chance? Yes. Ben, did you get a chance? Yes. Chauncey Gardner thinks that every time Jack Warden is the president is using the word chance, that he's asking him a question because his name is Chance the Gardener.
Oh,
Chauncey Gardner.
I get it.
Ben, did you get a chance? Yes. Did you get a chance? Yes. Ben, did you read my speech? It's part of the brilliance of being there. We are here and glad to be here. I had the chance, yes, to bring Pat Hill on to make it a quartet of guests today.
Yeah.
And I declined. Not because I don't love Pat Hill, I do. I really do. I like him. Didn't like him when he was beating us 44-24 24 years ago in that much anticipated opener in Fresno. But I like him. I kind of like, he reminds me of Dennis a little bit, just this tough old school ball coach guy who had wonderful teams, tough physical teams, and that's still the identity, and I'm expecting a good physical defense and a pretty good team that outscored Georgia Southern 29-0 in the second half. Anyway, we thought about bringing Pat on. We may play a snippet of what he said maybe before the end of this first segment, before Petros Papadakis joins us at 11:30. He called on FS1 the Fresno State 29-0 romp in the second half against Georgia Southern. Petros, our good friend, at 11:30. Alan Thayer, our good friend at 12:05, and a guy that's been a friend to the show and to Oregon State football as an outstanding corners coach for Mike Riley through some of the better years in Oregon State's football history, Nigel Burton, who will be on the call with Ted Robinson and Ryan Leaf come Saturday afternoon at Reser Stadium, Coach Nigel Burton at 12:30. But in saying no, in a sense, to Pat Hill, it's because, John, we want to get to some business from yesterday and unfinished business. And those of you that were kind enough to text some thoughts in about whatever I know we spent a good deal of time yesterday about the amazing life of George Raveling. So if you texted in on that or anything else we were kicking around, Dave Bartu from CFB Matrix Analytical, CFB Analytical, a world, I'm so dense that we barely scratch the surface on anything. It's a world I don't fully apprehend and probably never will, the world that he lives in, crunching all the numbers and data and so on. It's a lifestyle and a world with which I'm not familiar, but he, I could tell, will be available to us on occasion, you know, to talk, because he likes to. He loves it. He loves those numbers and the analytics and all of that. He's one of the cutting-edge guys hired by NFL teams and college programs all over the country. He's done direct work, as he told us, for Oregon State in terms of the D coordinator, the head coaching job. I mean, he's been in on with numbers analysis on here's why this guy is a good coach.
Yeah, and one thing I really appreciated about him is he's not like a computer guy who does have a personality. He knows the sport, loves the sport, but is really, really interested in the statistical side of things, but he gets it. So he also understood, no, you got to be a devil's advocate on things. He's not a computer geek, in other words. He's a sports guy that's really good with these numbers. I love it. It's a great combination.
We'll have Dave on again. We enjoyed visiting with Andy yesterday about the great George Raveling. But you were, John said, you were, during all of that, you were sending us some texts and thoughts. So, Johnny, we need to, rather than bring Pat Hill on live and occupy this first segment, let's get to the University Honda text line, some unfinished business from yesterday, maybe some new ones in today, and then we'll get into our guest cavalcade coming up at 11:30.
I'm not sure if I read this one, but I'll read it again. It was from Bob. He said, the funniest thing when George was, I did read it, but I'll read it again. When George was at USC and GP went for 58, Bob, you have 56 here, but it's 58. And then in the second half, GP, as he was dribbling the ball, tells George, George, get someone in here who can guard me. That's Larry Bird-esque.
Oh, my gosh. That is so great. Yeah. And you can tell Raveling had a story to tell for a lifetime, and so did Gary.
What? Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. This one is from Doug in Salem. And mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't really understand what Doug is saying, but he says, it seems like nobody, this was in the early stages of the show.
Yesterday.
Okay. Yes. So early first hour, it seems like nobody likes us, the great Joe Beaver show anymore.
What is that? Yeah.
Maybe this happens after we leave the Pac-12. Hope we can get guests on your show. Just need to get someone who is not too old, like the coach from Fresno State. So I'm not sure.
I'm not sure where Doug is going with this. I'm not sure if he's just talking about he's not sure anybody likes us, meaning the
not
writers.
Likes the show, likes just likes us, meaning
our world. The Oregon State.
Oregon State. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doug, I know you may or may not like us, but we are all you've got in the sense of the local Joe Beaver show. Thank you, though, Doug, as always, for the
contributions. Now, this next text we got to very late, but I did get to it. And I want to reintroduce it because I want to hear from fans about this, either on the text line or on the phone line, in between guests. But did anybody out there use the valet service? Paige asked that, and we didn't get any response on that. Anybody use the valet service? How did it go? Remember, Sarah, as she was presenting it, said it's in its infancy stages, and so this will be the first weekend kind of a thing. So how did it go, basically?
Okay.
I think I read that one already, and then we get into, here's a rumor. Do we want to read anything about rumors?
Not necessarily. No. Okay. No. In fact, I mean, maybe during a break I'll see what but I don't like to just throw things out there willy-nilly.
No,
thank you for
your
editorial position as your move on the fly. Good work.
The analytics guy was fascinating. Well done. Get him back.
Yes.
By the way, if I was interviewing a head coach that said he wouldn't use analytics, I'd move on.
Right.
My question was, are you willing? Of course you're going to use it.
That's a given.
Are you willing to say, no, I don't think so, not this time. And so that's not bad. Okay, well, Mark says an add-on from, not sure if David Nishitani or others in our men's lunch group shared this, but quote, just saw where George Raveling passed away at 88. I took this at an OSU Washington State basketball game way back when, and it's a picture of, it's a picture of the coach leaping up into the air in exuberance. I don't know what the case was, but anyway. Add-on from Scott Spiegelberg. What a photo, Nish. I remember a game where Coach Raveling had sweats and a warm-up on and went through the pregame warm-up in Gill. And then he said he said more on that. Okay, there was a question about getting the podcast, KEJOAM.com. That's the answer to that. Here's another one. Oh, actually, this one came in just today.
Okay.
This is from, it's really long, from TH. Hi, Mike and John. The Holt Center is presenting Gene Frith, Inside America's Favorite Pastime, on Monday, February 2nd, 26, in the Soreng Theater. I have to get through all the thing here. Would you please consider having Gene on your show as a guest? I find her 2024 World Series and Women in Baseball work to be illuminating. And here's another really long link. And then she says, it appears she can't be reached through, okay. Well, anyway, that's how we would get a hold of this person. All right. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, that's
a ways off. I don't really think I'm not much into the history of baseball.
Yeah, no.
No, I mean, that sounds, to use the word we used with Bar 2, and so did the texter, it's the right word, though. That sounds like a fascinating show. And so, yes, thank you, whoever, T.H., do we know who T.H. is?
It says from Richard.
Picard?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Picard.
Essentially, well, I don't know. Yeah,
oh,
I don't
okay.
know.
But thank you, Richard.
Essentially, most of this is... It's the words that this person wants to say with the link to things.
Okay.
So I have to look at it and stop where the sentence ends and where this long link starts and then find the new sentence. And so I don't want to miss anything here.
I understand.
In amongst all of these words. Okay, da-da-da-da-da. But at the end it says, included here is a picture of Vince Scully in his booth preparing for a game. Hmm. Some of his notes are in large print. Well, I haven't looked at the links yet to see that. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on. So that's that. We can certainly look into that for you, Richard, and take care of that.
Gosh, that's a really nice. I had no idea. That sounds like a wonderful exhibit and show.
Yeah.
So thank you for that, Richard. We will look into it. That's a little ways down the road now. And Vin Scully on his chart, see what large letters he wrote with his own hand, to coin a phrase. Now, Andy McCloskey sent me, speaking of Nish, a follow-up saying, thanks for having me on. A few years ago, Dave Nishitani Nish was kind enough to send me pictures of George in the sweat outfit. I thought George was going to put one in his book, which apparently he didn't. Nish did not have one of George's dunks. George rose up for a dunk during warmups. He was born in, so you tell me, that was the 1982 season.
He was born in 37.
He was born in 37.
And I'll tell you how I know
that. How old is he? Okay, but how old is he in 82 when he's dunking at Gill?
47, 77, 45.
That's pretty good. Pretty good athleticism.
Well, and this picture of him jumping in the air, he's got a suit on?
Yeah.
He's got serious height.
He's up.
Yeah, he's up.
And it's in a full suit, not the sweat outfit that he warmed up.
No, he's in a coat and tie.
So Nish, the great photographer Dave Nishitani, did not have one of George's dunk, but George appreciated our effort to get a lot of those pics to him. And then Andy sent a link, Andy McCloskey did, to George's book that I think maybe one of his last, but What You're Made For, with the foreword by Michael Jordan himself. And Michael, one of the early items that comes up in all of the obituaries that have been out on the late, great George Raveling is, of course, a quote. You go to the big ones first, the big names first, about what George's life meant, and two or three paragraphs into talking about the fact that George had passed is Michael saying, I would not have come to Nike except for George Raveling. Yeah. There'd be no Air Jordan without George.
So yesterday, I've been, buying a lot of audiobooks since I started on this, months ago. And for the first time, I've gotten away from time travel for interest. And I bought the George Raveling book yesterday after the show.
This one?
Yeah.
What You're Made For.
Yeah.
Okay,
and
cool.
It's Michael Jordan with the foreword, which is very good. And then the first paragraph, or well, not paragraph, but the first part of the first chapter, I only got through a little bit of it. His father died when his father was 49 years old of a heart attack, and it was just he and his mom in Washington, D.C. in the 30s. He's as old as my mom is. That's how I know he was born in 37.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it started, he's not the voice of it. There's a different narrator, but it's already, I'm halfway through the first chapter, and I'm like, this is going to be great.
Charles Barkley, this is a must-read book from Chuck. George Raveling, the book, What You're Made For, Powerful Life Lessons from My Career in Sports. What a career it was, and the many decades it spanned, the multitude of lives that he touched. If you have any thoughts before we break, feel free to jump in now. We're going to have Petros at 11:30, but if you have anything on the Downward Dog phone line, we've got a few minutes, about 10 before we break, 497-5356, 547-5356. One of the themes that Andy touched on was echoed by Craig Elo, who did text me. All he said was, I couldn't do it today. It was dealing with something with his mother-in-law, I guess. He said, George was a remarkable man. We can celebrate all that he did. He always said, how can I help you? And that's what something Andy said.
Yes.
Just what a servant's heart and someone who was looking to always be reaching out and helping people. That's a wonderful legacy.
And that's interesting because that's a very specific thing that Andy said yesterday.
Yeah, right. It's a little bit to me, even though the other day I was in before our game against Cal, the Beavers play Fresno State on Saturday, but before the game against Cal, back when spirits were bright and enthusiasm was high, and it's going to be again. We believe that it's going to be again. But one of the things we were talking about at one of the tailgates was the life of Bill Walton and how Bill, a little bit along the lines of George, how can I help you? Something he must have said to a lot of people because we heard that from Andy. Craig Elo on a text said the same thing. Craig played on Georgia's NCAA tournament team at Washington State in 1983, the final season Coach Ravelin coached in Pullman. 11 years, his longest stint and run as a coach was in Pullman. And he was a charismatic figure, the first black coach in the Pac-8. And then I didn't know that he was also the first black coach at Iowa, too. I mean, these are things that I learned, and I'm sure the book will talk about all of the life lessons and things as being a pioneer in sport and having the Martin Luther King Jr. speech, the typewritten manuscript. That's incredible that his life, that happened in his life. But one of the things that came up from just seeing that from Craig Elo, how can I help you, made me think of Bill, and we were talking about that in the parking lot before the game, the late, great Bill Walton, with saying to people, thank you for my life. It seemed a little hyperbolic, a little bizarre even, but he would...
Dramatic,
but he would say, I have texts with him, and I've saved them, we'll preserve the texts as long as I possibly can from the great Bill Walton. Thank you for my life. And Lydia, my daughter, said the first time Bill was sort of getting reintegrated back into the Pac-12 world, he made an appearance on campus and spoke to students, introduced a couple of people, including me, and I thought, I've interviewed Bill a few times. We've interacted a few times. But when he introduced me to this group, he said, I thank Mike Parker for my life. And, that type of drama thing. And I'm kind of looking around, what have I done for his life? But the point is, he said that to many people.
Yeah.
He said that to a lot of people. But he meant it. I thank you for how your life, and these moments right now, you're contributing to the fabric of my life. So he would say that to Ted Robinson, to a broadcast partner, to Dave Pash, to Roxy, to whomever. Thank you for my life.
Yeah, he meant it.
And he meant it. And I appreciate that as sort of a life motto. And George, what can I do to help? How can I help you?
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing from George Raveling's life. Let's go to Tumwater. We'd love to hear from you in the next few minutes via the text line. We'll get that Pat Hill queued up before we break. But Dave, and so we won't have a live conversation, but reprise something from 3 years ago from the old ball coach at Fresno State. Dave, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I just had to call in and tell you that interview yesterday with Dave Martu, it's one of the best you've ever done. He was just pure gold. You need to get him on as often as possible. In fact, I dare say he deserves a nationwide audience.
Well, he has
perspective
it. Yeah. I think I don't know how often he does radio shows. I know he goes on with our buddy Chad Dewing on Rip City Radio 620 on occasion. I've heard him. That's where I first heard him. But I think he does have a national cachet. Chris Fowler, I got this from Dave himself, and he didn't say this on the air. He could have, but he texted me back and says, Chris Fowler calls me every Friday before whatever game it is he's doing to hit me up on stuff. So that's who he is.
Wow, he's just gold.
Yeah.
Alan Thayer's on today.
Yes, he is. 12:05.
Looking forward to that. But back to Bartu for a second. As I said, I can't speak complimentarily enough. But I have to say that when he talked about the analytics proved that Trent Bray was a good coach for the last three or four. Guys, I could sitting in the stands at Reser Stadium. I'm just a guy from 190 miles away in Tumwater could tell Trent Bray was going to be a great coach. So, and the only other thing I teased it yesterday. One other thing I picked up when in town for the game last weekend. I think it's a positive development, if true, Although one of the constant refrains in the Old Testament in particular, guys, is people are always grumbling. There will be grumbling about this, but I want to encourage
okay.
you. They're thinking about putting a seat donation overlay on season ticket renewals for baseball. That's long overdue. Mm. That's the rumor I heard. People will grumble about it. The program needs the money. I'm in favor of it, even though it will complicate my and other people's lives. But I think it's long past due that they put, since there's a 99% season ticket renewal, all those people that show up in June for the regionals, you never see them in February and March. They can afford to pay a season ticket surcharge as a donor fee if they want the privilege of going to a regional in June. So that's all I got today, guys.
Thank you.
Great show. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Dave. Hey, before we break, and thank you for them. By the way, Alan Thayer is going to touch on a lot of things, including what does the House settlement mean for everybody in a sense, but specifically our world, but for Beaver baseball, for example, just what does it all mean going forward now with no walk-ons any longer, with roster limitations, no scholarship limitations. You can scholarship everybody up to whatever the roster limit is for a particular sport. So baseball's in a different world now from the 11.7. What does that mean? How will that look going forward? And perhaps what Dave just touched on is going to help the bottom line coffers to try to continue to to make sure that Oregon State baseball is in a position to keep thriving and building and making trips to the College World Series and all the things that we have adored and appreciated and savored here. We don't want those days to end, but certainly times are going to be much more challenging for everybody in the years ahead. Pat Hill touched on this 3 years ago. As we go to break, we're going to bring Petros up. Pat Hill, 75-year-old, former Fresno State head coach. He and Dennis had some great battles over several years. The Beavers went 2-1. The one was a memorable defeat to David Carr down there that many of you attended and said, never again, I'll never go to Fresno again. The Beavers beat him the following year in Corvallis, 59-19, after the 44-24 loss to Carr and company in that much-anticipated opener in 01. In 99, the Beavers beat Fresno State in Dennis's first year at Reser, 46-23. So the beatdowns were considerable, all three games. They weren't terribly competitive. The last time the two teams met in 22 was. The Beavers had to rally to win an exciting game with Coletto scoring as time expired, 35-32. There's recent history there with Fresno State, and of course, coming back as the Beavers did, 28-0 to win 31-28 in what was then the biggest comeback in NCAA football history at Parker Stadium in 1981. Big Jim Wilson on the O-line for that Joe Avezzano squad. All of that part of the background of the history, and we asked Pat Hill about the future of college football. This was 3 years ago when USC and UCLA had announced their intentions to leave.
It's not playing for some reason.
Okay, well, let's hold on. We'll try again.
It played yesterday, and it's saying it's a bad code. It's a bad code. Hold on. Let me try something else. I don't make this.
I'm not upset with you.
I know.
Understand?
Here we go.
Thank you.
I said it in 1998. I thought there'd be 32-team leagues, maybe 64 teams. It's boiled down to one's going to be owned by Fox and one's going to be owned by ESPN. And, if they want to cut down even more, more power to them. I think they ought to develop their own league, go by their own rules, and let the rest of us play intercollegiate athletics, if that's what it's going to be. I mean, if you want to get in the arms race, get in the arms race. If you qualify, get in it. Let them have their own rules. We don't even have a salary cap now in college football. There's no rules. It's just... kids can transfer for whenever they want. It's the portal and the whole thing about NLI and our NIL and if that's the direction of college football, then you always hear the big guys separate and doing it them on their own. Well, if they want to do that, then let them do it. And I think football will still survive at a very, very high level, and I think people will really like amateur athletics as much as they liked it 10 years ago.
No, I love. That was Pat Hill on the future, the big-time future of college football. Later, we need to take a break.
I'll find it.
And we'll have Pat talking about, because this was 2022 now, 3 years ago, and we speculate, hey, well, in the Pac-12's world, who knows what's coming? How would Fresno State be as an addition to the Pac-12? Well, that's happened now, as we well know, and it begins next year. We'll get Pat's thoughts, what he was thinking about that 3 years ago, a little later in the show. But up next, our good friend Petros, right here on Joe Radio.
All right, here we go. Welcome back here as we continue on with the Joe Beaver Show. John Warren, along with Mike Parker, we're bringing in our first guest of the day. Don't forget, later on, Alan Thayer will join us at 12:05 and Nigel Burton coming up at 12:30. But right now, we're bringing in the great Petros Papadakis. Petros, Mike said, you bring in Petros because I hear you every Wednesday morning, and I just love that segment. This last Wednesday, yesterday was a little bit more serious because you were breaking down a lot of what had happened in college football, including our next opponent in Fresno State. So I hope you enjoyed doing that morning slot. I know you're out here with us on the West Coast and it's really early, but you're not alone. Let me just put it that way. Welcome to the program.
Oh, my pleasure, John. You hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound great.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, everything's usually a little foggy that time of day on Wednesday. I set my alarm for 4:50 and we're on the air at 5, so that's the way we've done it for years, though, and I do appreciate doing it. It was very interesting, though, to think about the three big storylines that everybody talked about in college football this year, all offseason, the Arch Manning, the Bill Belichick, and then to a third, more distant degree would be Dico Iamaliava at UCLA, the number one transfer quarterback in the portal. And all three of those entities or people did not have a great week one. So it seems like we spent a lot of time talking about nothing all offseason. We didn't, but it's kind of interesting the way that always plays out year in and year out.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that I really appreciate, and I know Mike does too, and a lot of us out here, is that you're a national voice, a national guy, and yet you're still calling these games out here. You're calling Mountain West teams. You're calling maybe some Pac-2 and some other things out on this part of the country, along with the bigger games as well. And I like that because we still have a big name and a big voice to maybe help us out a little bit, because right now Oregon State and Washington State are as far off the grid football-wise as you can get.
Yeah, it's kind of a sad reality that you guys have been pretty close to and sort of watched develop over the last few years. But, yeah, I do a little mix of games. I do the games that I'm assigned. I enjoy West Coast football. I have good relationships with a lot of the Mountain West coaches and will be interested to see what happens in the future with the Pac-2 and the Pac-12 or whatever we're going to call it. I don't believe I'm going to be working. I work at Fox, and they have a CBS deal and a deal with somebody else. And so that's a little different from what I'm used to. But I call the games I'm assigned. I was in East Lansing on Friday night to do a Michigan State game. I came back and did the Fresno game. This week I'm off. And then I'll be back at it in Logan next week. So we'll see Utah State and Bronco Mendenhall's guys. So I never really know where I'm going, and it's usually a surprise every couple weeks when we get the game assignments. So, but I'm always looking forward to it because whenever you get assigned the game, it's your game, and you don't have to really worry about too much else. And you know what to study, and you know what to become a quote-unquote expert in. Celebrate the players and the teams and the coaches and live to fight another day. That's been my motto for years.
Petros Papadakis joining us on the Joe Beaver Show. Looking forward to getting Petros's thoughts on Fresno State here in a moment. But one thing on the national picture over the weekend and the week zero, notwithstanding kind of the big grand opening of the college football season and the storylines you mentioned and those three that you talked about, it didn't go so well for Belichick, Nico, Arch. Petros, is there coming back for those three? Who has the likely path to kind of, hey, put that in the rearview mirror and come back in a big way, in your opinion, going forward?
That's a great question, because Arch Manning didn't look good. I mean, he missed a lot of throws and did not look comfortable. And yeah, as Brady Quinn pointed out on the show that John was talking about, Ohio State's defense is really good, and maybe Arch's shoulder was a little messed up or whatever else Brady said. But at the same time, we didn't spend the whole offseason talking about Ohio State's defense. You know, we didn't spend the whole offseason talking about Arch Manning's shoulder. None of us knew that he was even hurt, if he was. So he looked a lot more like that guy in the very first spring game to me than the guy that started against Monroe and Mississippi State last year. So usually, and you guys know this, when something looks really bad, it's not as bad as it looked. And if something looks really good, usually it's not as good as it looks. And that's generally how football teams play out in the first game. But I'd like to see him play a lot more efficient football, and I think he will. The Belichick thing is also, I mean, there's always room for improvement. We're talking about a coach, not a player. Mm-hmm. And the quarterback always gets too much credit and too much blame, but I'm not really sure where that goes with the ACC situation. I think they'll be mediocre, probably like they were last year, which isn't really the end of the world. And then the UCLA is interesting because, you know, we talked about this coordinator that came from Indiana, like UCLA was going to have an offense like Indiana last year. And I commend UCLA for playing a real opponent, mm-hmm. you know, for scheduling Utah in the first game. And I think that they should take a little less heat because they played somebody good. But at the same time, I mean, you have the number one quarterback in the portal. It's kind of like last year with Aiden Childs and Jonathan at Michigan State. You have the number one quarterback in the portal, and everybody expects a whole bunch, but your team is just not really where they need to be. And this is year two for Deshaun, and I saw Jonathan's team last week, and they are a lot better. Mm-hmm. They were pretty bad, so I don't know how much a lot better gets them in the Big Ten, but I think that they'll be a bowl team, which is a step in the right direction, obviously. And I think Aiden Childs will do a better job playing within himself. The guy they brought in to be the offensive coordinator at UCLA, everybody thought was going to be like Indiana. He was a co-coordinator at Indiana, but this is his first year calling plays. So there's going to be an adjustment period for him. And UCLA did not look very aggressive or ready to go on defense. So they're going to play a tough UNLV team that's well-coached in Allegiant on Saturday night. And UNLV's bigger, stronger, and faster. They might not be better than they were last year, but they're bigger, stronger, and faster than they were last year. And that seemed to be a problem for UCLA with that Utah team. So I think they're going to be in a struggle against UNLV, and this kid's going to have to make some plays and win the game, and I'd like to see that happen. But as far as who's got the best chance to come back, probably Texas, because they'll just throw money at it.
They have it to throw, not unlike other programs I can think of here at the moment. Petros Papadakis joining us on the Joe Beaver Show. Petros, in terms of transfer portal quarterbacks and who's the number one guy, I didn't see every game, but I'm telling you what, the transfer portal kid from Cal to Oregon and back to Cal. I don't know how much you saw of the California-Oregon State game, but maybe in a way of transitioning into our game with Fresno State, did you see anything or at least read the storylines or highlights or whatever of JKS debuting for Justin Wilcox's program and how that game went from your perspective in Corvallis on Saturday?
Tell me about it, because I know that the Cal looked good, and that's a kid from Hawaii, am I correct?
Yes, that's right.
Breaking
all the records over there, Gabriel, Tua, and Marcus, yes.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but I know that Cal was dominant, and they have a brand-new football team because their quarterback is at Indiana with that guy, Cignetti. It's hard to keep up. It's like an airline. It's unbelievable. But no, I did not see much of the game. Cal is sadly not as much on my periphery because of the ACC, and I haven't seen the Beavs in a couple years, though I always root for them. But I did see that Fresno State team last week.
Yeah.
And they have two games under their belt, and that was pretty interesting.
And what did you see from them? What kind of team are the Beavers coping with Saturday afternoon at Reser at 12:30?
Well, I mean, they're well coached, and they have a coach who is, I think, going to be a very desired coach, depending on how much success he has at Fresno. He had a lot of respect from me. I called a game of his when he was at North Dakota State, Matt Entz. And we all know about North Dakota State and the brand of football they play and what kind of guy this is. I was very surprised when USC hired him to be a defensive linebacker coach mm-hmm. for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that, got away from Fargo, lived where I live in Palos Verdes Estates, and kind of got the itch to be a head coach somewhere halfway through the season and saw that this was a good fit, you know, as far as the physicality and the anger and the grittiness that we all kind of associated with Fresno football and Pat Hill and Sweeney and all that. And so he's up there. And in their first game, E.J. Warner, Kurt's Warner's son, they had chances to make it a closer game, but they had some turnovers, and they weren't going to be able to overcome that against a well-coached Kansas team. They did the same thing against Clay Helton's team early in the game. They were moving the ball. E.J. was throwing it pretty well. And then all of a sudden, he threw two pretty bad picks. And Georgia Southern is not helpless on offense. And they had a lead at halftime. And it was 100-plus degrees in the Green Valley. And people were angry, you know.
Yeah.
And you could just tell that Matt Entz, he was wearing his tactical, like, glasses with the clear lenses. And they came out and he had his jaw set and you could just see like, oh God, they're, you know, what are they going to do? And they just ran the ball brilliantly and just basically took the will of the Georgia Southern team in the heat. And they have a great running back, a very good running back, I should say, in Bryson Donaldson, and love watching him run the ball. Big, strong kid with some breakaway ability who they want to give the ball about 18 times a game to. And then they have a changeup guy, Speedy Luke, who was a huge recruit out of this area, ended up in Arizona with a lot of the Bosco guys or Servite guys, and then had a fledgling career there and ended up at Fresno. But he's one of the faster football players in all of college football. And, you know, sometimes you get a guy who's really fast, but you never really get to see him run free.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Especially at the running back position. And he was starting to run free in a moment or two in that game. And he put together a good game. And then they have another short yardage back who's good. They have a really one great corner that you can't really throw over there, a zillion Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Two angry white safeties in Tierney and Braca, who come up and tackle, and fast linebackers. I was pretty impressed with the way they kind of took over in the second half and basically put their foot down and said, we're not going to lose another game because the cornerback's throwing picks. We're not going to do it. We refuse to have that happen. So that was my takeaway, that they're a very physical football team and they want to exert physicality and they're going to try to minimize the mistakes that the quarterback has been making. And if he makes more mistakes, they might end up going with the backup who is a transfer from Sacramento State.
Who they brought in for one series, didn't they, in that game? They brought him in for a play?
Yeah, he came out and played a little at the end, But I think they're going to want it. I mean, they have three tight ends. They're going to want to run the ball. They're going to pull the tight ends around and lead them through like fullbacks. And they're going to live and die like that and play real football. So the Beavs have got to be up to that. And if they're not up to that, they're going to be 0-2, which is very upsetting.
Yeah. Hey, Petros, you also talked about the pullers were pulling in that second half in particular. So what kind of scheme to get that 232 yards rushing, whatever it was they had in the second half, and outscoring them 29-0? EJ didn't throw it much at all, but were the pulling linemen a big part of how they attacked?
Yeah, they were pulling people around, pulling the tight ends around especially, and just running, you know, zone-style running where everybody steps together. They seemed to do both. They cut off the backside really well, and they just got an incredible push. They have a really good center who's been there for a while that that they've kind of gotten behind. They have an angry Latino short yardage back that reminds me a little bit of myself when I was a young man.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've always liked Fresno football, and I think they have a really good coach. You know, I feel a little bit like this guy, and I know it's not a popular opinion here in week one in 2025, but we all know that Kalen DeBoer is and was a great coach, you know, here on the West Coast, and maybe taking over for Nick Saban for anybody would be an impossible task. Maybe they turn it around and end up having a really good year. But either way, it reminds me of when DeBoer was at Fresno, that this guy is that kind of coach, and they're going to have similar kind of success.
They've had a run of good coaches, and the way you described how that game played out in the second half after they got tired of the interceptions sounds so much like a North Dakota State type situation. And
right.
I'm wondering if you, I mean, there's no way to know. I mean, obviously we don't know, but do you kind of get a feeling though that Oregon State can see more of that run push? In other words, like they're like, you know, until you can do a few things, EJ, we're just going to run the ball.
Yeah. I mean, if I was Oregon State, that's what I would do. Yeah. I mean, I would load the box and dare them to run the ball at me. And I would drop eight when they throw, and let's see if EJ can pick us apart that way. But I would force this kid to throw and make mistakes, and see how that goes. And obviously, you know, you got to minimize your own mistakes, and that's such a big part of the first part of the year in college football. But yeah, I would, you know, obviously their run game is what they do best right now. So if I was the Beavs, I would try to lengthen the game and get them to make mistakes, you know.
Yeah. Hey, Petros, final thing. You touched on Brandon Ramirez, their short yardage back. He also looked good swinging out of the backfield, catching a ball. But I was really proud of the moment when the people at FS1 pulled up the clip of you scoring touchdowns. You had 16 rush touchdowns in your career at USC, and so they were bringing your stuff up with respect to Brandon Ramirez. Do you have a favorite of those 16? Was there one or two or a few? That's a lot that stick out for you in your run at USC.
You know, it is funny because when you're a young person, you know, it's hard to remember how anything made you feel, let alone, you know, there's not enough pores in your body to absorb what it's like to score a touchdown in a college football game with, you know, 70, 80,000 more, you know, people in the stands. And it's deafening. It's emotionally deafening. So those things always just kind of happen to me. And then you just, you know, the real things you remember are being on the bus and the feelings you had before the game and being in the hotel and being with your teammates and things of that nature. You know, it was always great to be in the end zone and celebrate with everybody and come to the sideline and know everybody was looking at you. I mean, we all have a little vanity, but I had a really long one. I had a few long touchdowns before my leg fell off, but I had a really long one at Washington State in 1998, like 50-something yards on the old AstroTurf. Mm-hmm. And I remember Martin Stadium was full that night, but, you know, not a lot of SC folks make that trip. And, you know, it was so quiet when I broke free that I could hear my own breathing and my own footsteps on the, and, you know, and that's, you know, and it's so surreal to have that happen. You know, you feel like maybe there was a penalty or maybe something happened or maybe you slipped into a wormhole, you know, into an alternate dimension and no one was watching anymore. And I remember turning around and looking, you know, to see if there was a penalty or anything like that once I reached the end zone. But, yeah, that was pretty surreal, scoring a long touchdown up in Pullman against Bill Doba's guys and having it, you know, just be so quiet.
Yeah.
Breaking through, because, you know, you carry the ball most places, you know, especially a home game. And even though the Coliseum, you know, is kind of big and spread out, I mean, it's still loud as hell.
Yes.
And even though, you know, and even though you're the home team on offense, it's loud. And I don't think what people realize is, you know, when you get the ball, the crowd sees a hole pretty much the same time that you see a hole, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So the crowd jumps as your heart jumps, you know what I mean, as you try to get going on a run, the crowd is getting going too. And that's a weird feeling, you know, just to hear, you know, you know, tens of thousands of people, you know, see an opening like when you see it.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an odd vibe.
Yeah.
But we got to beat Fresno, guys, because Texas Tech is coming up after that, and then we got Oregon. I mean, come on.
I'm glad you put it in the weave. That makes us feel better up here, to John's point. Petros, we do. We need to beat Fresno. Hey, thank you for the time, as always. You've been a great friend to us for many years, and we appreciate having you on. Thanks for making time, Petros.
No problem, guys. Love you, and have a great day. Good luck.
Thank you, man. And what a good dude.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, and he means it. We got to beat Fresno.
Yeah.
And he means it. That's a we.
Yeah.
And that's a we that, with respect to Mike Riley, whom he played for.
And
Mike was an OC
for
him, and he has family here. He's a Beaver. He's got a lot of Oregon State in him. We love
him. I hear him mention Oregon State when it works.
Yeah.
He doesn't force it in, but...
Did he mention it when they got to go to Corvallis?
No.
Or as Pat Hill would say, Corvallis. Let's take a break, and then we'll close the top of the hour. Let's find that other bite from Pat, since Fresno State's coming Saturday, and they'll be coming more often in the future. We'll break, wrap up hour number one with Alan Thayer and Nigel Burton coming up next hour. Excellent work by Johnny behind the scenes to pull up the follow-up from 3 years ago, about this time, almost 3 years ago to the date. Pat Hill was on this show. We talked about he said in 98, we got to go to super, you know, we probably are going to go to super conferences and then let everybody else do their thing. You heard him talk about that before we had Petros on. My follow-up 3 years ago was, not knowing what was going to happen with the Pac-10-12, we knew USC and UCLA were leaving, but those were the only ones at the time that we were having that conversation with Pat that we knew were gonzo. But then I asked Pat then, well, what about, you know, the future of the Pac-12? What's that going to look like? Would Fresno State be a good addition? Would they want to make the jump to the Pac-12?
Okay.
Absolutely. If we're willing as a community and as a university to make that commitment, absolutely. But there's a lot of people in those leagues that aren't really willing to make the commitment if they didn't get the TV money, you know?
Yeah.
So if you're going to be in a position where our community will make the commitment, no problem, and our university will make the commitment. Fresno State is... I mean, we get as many people at games as most of the Pac-12 schools. I mean, football is important here. And I think if the opportunity is given to Fresno State, I think this school could really turn into a powerhouse. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt in my mind.
Coach.
But if they don't, and we will still have college football no matter what happens here at Fresno State, because it's a way of life here.
Pretty good answer, I thought. I mean, he was buoyant, upbeat about the prospect, and now it's a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be a good partner in the Pac-12 because of it's a way of life here. Their commitment, their love of football in the Valley is on a very high level, and the crowds, and we've all experienced it. We know what it's like to go down there and play. It ain't easy. Ask Jones or Dennis or anybody else.
And we know this. We know this program because of the history of the two teams over the last 20, 25 years, even before that. So I would say, and it sounds like this NC guy or NC is a great coach. Another one that's come to Fresno State. And I don't know, I kind of like last week, I was feeling pretty good, but after Petros and after the stats of that second half, 29-0, 250 some odd yards on the ground.
Right.
I'm a little worried, Doc.
Yeah, well, we ought to be.
I'm a little worried.
We ought to be.
And we don't need that. We don't need that to be good. We need...
Well, Petros just said we can't be 0-2.
Okay? No.
I got you, Petros. No, we agree. We all agree on that, as Jonathan Winters once memorably said. Now, Alan Thayer will join us to talk about a motion to dismiss that he does not believe will be granted come Tuesday, and he has reasons why, but he also has thoughts about the House settlement, what it means, what the nil world looks like going forward, trying to maybe help us understand what it will mean and means to Oregon State specifically and other programs, but other programs it spent lavishly before the House settlement came in, kind of like, we got to get it all in, we got to pay now, we got to pay now. Where does that leave some of those programs with what he thinks, I think, and he'll explain why, he believes the 12-factor test about does a nil agreement meet this 12-factor test, he thinks is going to have more teeth, so to speak, than maybe, you know, under the deal, under the table deals that have gone on forever in college sports. It may be a little harder to get those done now because they're serious about policing and making sure deals meet market value, I think. So that could help be an equalizer in the new world. Alan Thayer and Nigel next hour.
The Joe Beaver Show is on the air.
For years, there were forebodings, but did the powers that be pay enough attention?
We're on the eve of destruction.
And then it happened, gradually and suddenly.
You finally really did it. You maniacs! You blew it up!
The why and the wherefore of the destruction continues to be well documented, but the more pressing question now, of course, is... The answer to that existential question is not fully known, but what is known is that Beaver Nation carries on, speaking as one through it all.
Been in trouble, but I'm okay. Been through the ringer, but I'm okay.
We're strong enough to take it. We can make it.
And we have made it, at least one more time, to another edition of the Joe Beaver Show on 1240 Joe Radio, KEJOAM.com, and 93.7 FM.
Christopher probably sang that at the Richfield Amphitheater this past Saturday.
I can't believe I missed that.
Playing there with Men at Work and Toto.
Toto. I would have gone just to see Toto.
Yeah. So it's all right. I think we're going to make it. The always upbeat, positive outlook we have in our world in Beaver Nation. And helping us along the way through all of these challenging, trying times and all manner of questions to deal with has been... Alan Thayer with Innovative Law Group in Eugene and the creator of Beavers Behind Enemy Lines and featured prominently as a super fan for Oregon State Athletics in this current edition of the Oregon Stater. Susan Schmidt, Alan Thayer, and others all featured. The Cookie Man, Lou, I mean, it's a really nice feature among the other things that Kip Carlson did in making a deep dive into the history of payments to student-athletes, scholarships, what student-athletes have been able to get through the years, what the House settlement may mean. And Alan Thayer is featured in that, not so much for what he's about to share with us along those lines, but more that he is indeed a great Beaver, quote, behind enemy lines, unquote, and has been kind enough to share his knowledge and insight into the legal machinations going on between first the departing schools from the Pac-12, and now the Pac-12 v. the MW, the Mountain West. A motion to dismiss is coming up on Tuesday that Alan can perhaps share his thoughts about. A lot of things, as always, to get into. Alan, good afternoon. Thank you for your time. There's almost too much on the list, so I don't even know where we start. We'll just start with how are you today?
Well, I am good. It's good to be here behind enemy lines. One thing that you may not know about me in my law office that I'm standing in right now, the walls in my office are orange. So we carry the Beaver faith down here all that we can.
We appreciate that, Alan, but there's so much to talk about, a lot of questions. If anybody has any questions for Alan you want to submit via the University Honda text line, 541 541- 877-497-5356. Alan, where do you want to begin? What's sort of occupying your thinking, your mind right now about all the stuff that we're dealing with at Oregon State?
Well, let's start with September 9th, this Tuesday. As people may recall, Oregon State entered into a scheduling agreement with the Mountain West. They were desperate for games. The Mountain West said, fine, Oregon State, Washington State, we'll schedule some games with you. And then they, in essence, charged $2 million per game when the going rate is $250,000 to $500,000 per game. So they kind of had us over the barrel one way. And then they also added the non-poaching provisions and said if Mountain West schools go and join the Pac-12, then you have to pay north of $10 million a school in poaching penalties. $55 million total for the five schools that will be joining the Pac-12 next season. So Oregon State said those provisions aren't enforceable, or at least the poaching provisions aren't enforceable. They filed an antitrust suit against Mountain West. The Mountain West filed a motion to dismiss the antitrust claims. It was actually kind of, as a lawyer who has worked on antitrust cases, I didn't think it was a particularly strong motion to dismiss. It sounded good, but when the Pac-12 filed their response to the Mountain West motion, it was both guns a-blazing and very, very strong on the legal argument. Mm-hmm. So when a party files a motion, they file a brief, then there is a response brief from the other party, and then the party who filed the initial motion gets to do a reply to what the other side said. Mm-hmm. They get the last word in the written argument.
And that's Tuesday?
No. That's already happened.
Okay.
And their response brief was underwhelming. They really did not counter the Pac-12's arguments in a significant way, at least in my estimation. Mm-hmm. And in the estimation of other lawyers who have reportedly commented on the current proceedings. So on Tuesday, they go to oral argument. Judge Wilkin, Claudia Wilkin, will in the Northern District of California, that's federal court, will hear arguments from both sides. And then afterwards, Judge Wilkin will make a ruling. She could rule from the bench on Tuesday with a written opinion to follow, or she could take it under advisement and issue a ruling with a written opinion in the next week or two or three. I will tell you, though, right now that I think the Pac-12 will prevail on the Mountain West motion to dismiss. And I suspect that Judge Wilkin, in her written opinion, will comment very specifically on the applicable antitrust laws and how they apply in this case.
Do you think there will be a panic then from the Mountain West and then a settlement?
I hope so. I hope there is a settlement. I mean, it'd be nice to get this over. The dispute between the Mountain West and the Pac-12 is very unfortunate. But, the Mountain West, at least under its current executive director, has done its absolute best to pick the Pac-12's pocket and do everything it can to make it difficult for the Pac-12 to survive. And so that the Pac-12's only options would be merging with the Mountain West, which a lot of Oregon State fans did not think that would be a good result.
Alan Thayer joining us on the Joe Beaver Show. The specter of treble damages with respect to antitrust matters. Alan, could you please explicate that a bit for us? As again, John asked, would the Mountain West quote-unquote panic? Well, what is the Mountain West up against potentially if they continue to try to carry this thing out?
So right now, the Pac-12's lawsuit only asked for a declaration that the poaching penalties are unenforceable. Mm-hmm. That's all they're asking for. Now, I mentioned here in the setup that Oregon State and Washington State, through the Pac-12, were charged $2 million a game when they should have been charged, let's go to the Hyatt, $500,000 a game. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like saying there's a water shortage, and I'm the only one in town with water. And if you want to buy my water, you have to pay a lot more than what it's worth. Mm-hmm. Well, the only reason why you're able to do that is because it's a monopoly at that point. You've cornered the market on water. And under the antitrust laws, that could be an antitrust violation. And if it's an antitrust violation, then you get three times your damages. So if they paid $1.5 million per game more than what those games are worth, times the number of games, times three for triple damages. And, oh, by the way, you also have to pay the Pac-12's attorney fees. Mm-hmm. The Pac-12 could amend its complaint to add a claim for antitrust damages. And now we're talking, I did the numbers, I think it worked out about $38 million that the Pac-12 might end up, or excuse me, the Mountain West might end up owing to the Pac-12.
That would almost bankrupt them.
Well, yeah. then what? I mean, do you feel like would the Mountain West be, in a sense, foolish to proceed with that specter rather than come to a settlement that what the Pac-12 is asking for now before perhaps the antitrust treble damages possibility enter in?
Well, I think so. First of all, I think it shows remarkable restraint by the Pac-12 to not lead with a claim for damages against the Mountain West, mm-hmm. and instead simply ask for relief from what are clearly, which seem to be clearly illegal, poaching penalties.
Right.
The
restraint. Go ahead. Yeah.
So they were restrained, and the reports are the executive director of the Mountain West just wasn't going to budge in her position.
Mm-hmm.
So one possibility would be that there's a clear ruling from the judge and explains how the antitrust laws apply in this instance. The expectations of the parties then are either equalized or the gap between the parties is lessened. And then Pac-12 said, hey, you know, let's settle or the other shoe's going to mm-hmm. drop. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to be a good thing for the Mountain West.
Don't you need to have both sides agree to something in a settlement? And to that I say, what would the Pac-12 give, if anything, in a settlement? Or would they just simply say, give us what we want, or we'll go to court and get more than what we want?
Oh, so there's two lawsuits. Three of the five schools have filed a separate lawsuit that said the $17.5 million exit fees mm-hmm. that you're charging us also are illegal under an antitrust standpoint. So you can, in the negotiation, you can negotiate both of those.
Yeah.
So, okay, you're entitled to something from your member schools that are leaving our exit fees. And so they can agree on exit fees, but then say, but there's no poaching penalties.
Right.
And in exchange for entering into an agreement, getting this done and moving forward, we won't bring a damage claim.
Mm-hmm. The restraint you say you feel has been remarkable. We're going to move on to the House settlement and matters now. We'll see how that all plays out. I like your sort of sanguine outlook with respect to how it's going to play Tuesday and what it may mean going forward. But the restraint partly has been motivated by, as much as Oregon State, all of the schools coming into the new Pac-12 need revenue, need money, they don't necessarily have an appetite to, as John said, bankrupt or destroy a conference on the way out, right? I mean, that's not in the best interest of college football or these other institutions remaining in the Mountain West. So the restraint, maybe, is it possible, is partly on the side of trying to make sure that they can continue to function and operate because of the treble damages they might not be able to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's real possibility. Now, listen, I got to tell you what I just shared with you.
Yes.
You're not going to find this anywhere except for discussions that I've had with one other journalist.
Sure. Canzano, right? John Canzano up north, right?
John Canzano. He has, he and I have talked about this and he's written about this, but I think he is the only one that is mentioning it.
Okay.
Now, I don't know this is happening. This is just my speculation.
Right.
But I think it's highly probable.
Okay.
All right, so I'm going to go to the text line. And interestingly enough, the first question comes from listener Dave, not Dave from Tumwater, to something Mike and I were actually going back and forth on during the break, and he puts it better than I could, and it's this. He says, if there's going to be oversight to make sure that deals, NIL is what we're transitioning into, meet the market value, remember that NIL Go company branched off of Deloitte, is that essentially mean that universities in larger markets can justifiably spend more money than universities in smaller markets? And the reason why we say that is because I looked this up. There's been $80 million already
of approved deals,
many of which are multi-million dollar deals since June 25th, which was when Deloitte took over, up to $80 million. And it's like, I say unto you, what were we talking about before June? Because it's like, I expected with the $600 marker, everything to come way down, but apparently it doesn't.
Well, there is a 12-factor test that Deloitte and NIL Go announced. They did it in the form of a 3-page memo to the schools. I did a quick search online. The only discussion that I have seen online, and I might have missed something, but the discussion primarily is from law firms that are trying to position themselves to bring NIL lawsuits on behalf of student athletes wanting more money.
Mm-hmm.
And this 12-factor test is designed to add economic substance to the deals and eliminate the pay-to-play aspect of NIL deals. Now, to listener Dave's question, would a sponsorship in or USC in the Los Angeles market, where the student athlete will record six different commercials and do some appearances and some stuff on social media, would that be worth a similar deal than in the Corvallis Portland market? And yeah, it would be under the NIL goes, 12-factor test, it absolutely would be worth more.
Yeah. Which makes sense.
Yeah, of course it would. But I guess now let's get to when you, Alan, you and I spoke earlier, and you said it, the new world in the NIL go, the House settlement, that we're all still trying to kind of fully figure out what it means now, what it may mean going forward. What do you say? That's a big picture question, but what does it mean? Let's say for the two in-state institutions, the one down the road where you're living behind enemy lines and where we are right here in the heart of the valley. What do you think it means for those two, just by one way of getting into the subject?
Well, so Mike Gundy is bringing his Oklahoma State Cowboys to Eugene this weekend. Mm-hmm. And ESPN quoted him as saying that last year, Oregon spent $40 million in NIL, and the Cowboys only spent $7 million in NIL. And he thought it was wrong to schedule non-conference games between teams with such economic disparity. Hmm. Then Yahoo Sports published an article with Dan Lanning's response. And Dan Lanning's response was kind of a smirk. Well, we spend to win. He did not
He didn't deny the 40.
But he also said Tennessee Martin probably doesn't spend as much as you did after you beat him up last week to Oklahoma State.
But the point, yeah, and that's a good point too, but the point disparity-wise.
Yeah.
But the point being, Alan, what, that Dan did not deny the 40 million figure. He just said we spend to win. So what? How do you interpret that?
Well, that's exactly how I interpret it. So last year was before the House settlement.
Yes.
So now we have the House settlement. And for compensation to athletes, there's now two different components. And one component is what's called revenue sharing. And a university can share up to $20.5 million with student-athletes. Now, that's all student-athletes in all sports. And each university can decide, are they going to revenue share? If they are going to revenue share, how much revenue will they divide? And then how will they divide that revenue between different sports and different athletes within the sport? And that is a calculus that Scott Barnes at Oregon State and athletic directors across the country are going to have to figure out. But let's talk about University of Oregon at the moment. So in terms of a media market, Eugene and Portland are nowhere near the size of the market of Los Angeles. So there ought to be some factor on NIL. Also, you take a player right out of high school that hasn't played a down of college football, their name ID is not going to command the high dollars of a quarterback that is well known. So presumably, the NIL component for the University of Oregon will be less lucrative mm-hmm. than the $40 million it has. Yeah. So it has $20 million. Perhaps it's going to have to spend half of that on female athletes, women athletes. That still has not been totally resolved. And then, okay, are they going to give any money to track? Are they going to give any money to baseball? Are mm-hmm. they going to give any money to basketball? How much of that are they going to spend in football? So it's become a lot more complicated for the University of Oregon to dump $40 million into football in any one season.
Alan, there is, we didn't even get to what it means today, but we got to touch base again with you soon. We have Nigel Burton coming up next to kind of get back to some X's and O's and football and how he sees the matchup. He'll be calling the game this weekend on the CW with Ted Robinson and Ryan Leaf. So we're going to kind of pick Nigel's brain about the game itself, what he saw from Oregon State. We're going to do that, but we didn't even touch the new roster limitations, roster limits. No walk-ons, no, you know, but you can scholarship everybody instead of just 85. I mean, what this all means. So, Alan, can we take that up the next time we talk? Because it's going to have huge consequences, is it not, for everything with the Beavers and everybody else?
Oh, absolutely. And to answer your question, of course, Mike, I'm happy to answer questions that you and John have and questions that Oregon State fans have.
And there's another lawsuit. It just came out, I don't know, yesterday, where players are gathering up together to say we need to play 5 years of football. No more redshirting or the redshirt year.
They should be eligible to play five years, which a lot of them have played six or seven lately with JUCO rulings. Everything the players have asked for, Alan, it seems, with the pendulum swinging, it has swung a long way in their direction. And so that still is what concerns me about lawsuits, about nil, and how much this player X is worth. I feel like there's a lot of stuff still ahead of us, right? So we appreciate your perspective as always and look forward to future conversations. Alan, thanks for making time again for us today.
Thank you, guys. Go Beavers.
Thank you. Alan Thayer, Behind Enemy Lines. Nigel Burton joins us next, sort of back to football, but the disparity that you speak of. Oklahoma State, Gundy almost is like, is he laying the groundwork now? We may go out there to Oregon
and
get beat badly, but they spent $33 million more than we did.
That's what he's doing.
Okay, thank you. We come back with Nigel on the Joe Beaver Show. Well, we shift from visiting with Alan Thayer, Innovative Law Group, litigation, lawsuits, motions to dismiss, the nil world. Name, image,
know. He
likeness,
might have
transfer portal. I mean, these days, it's a lot more and has been for many years now instead of, how do you see the matchup? Well, in a sense, though, because we start talking, Gundy's bringing up Mike Gundy, disparity in payrolls for his matchup. The Beavers and Fresno State, the Beavers have more money than Fresno State does. There's an article in the Fresno Bee about that this week, about how Fresno State's got to spend more to catch up to play ball in the Pac-12. It's an interesting topic, as always, of course, but we are sort of interested in talking about the matchup on the football field this Saturday. But I'm sure our guest, a good friend of the show and to the Beavers through the years, Nigel Burton, joins us. Nigel, I don't even know where to begin with questions like that, always sort of in the undercurrent these days in college football, money and spending and all of that. But I guess I will just start with thanks for coming on. And how do you see the matchup this weekend at Reser?
Oh, Mike, always a pleasure to hear from you, my friend. On the previous subject, we have our show that's on the CW in Portland. I'm not sure if it's down there in the Valley yet, but Northwest Football Preview, me and Nick Aliotti and Mike Yam. And I said, you know, it's funny, all this complaining about money. I don't remember Mike Gundy complaining when T. Boone Pickens was alive. and he was getting bankrolled, which is what allowed him to catch up to Oklahoma. But, I guess you get forgetful, over all those years. But anyway, I think the matchup this week is going to be a great one. I think, you know, last weekend was just one of those, just you look at it and I think, the Beavs going against Cal, I honestly believe it's one of those things as a coach, you know, it's never as good as you thought and it's never as bad as you thought. I think they're going to look at that film and realize they had a lot of chances to get back in that game and win it. And I don't think the score was indicative of how that game really went. The quarterback, the freshman at Cal is, I haven't seen anything like that in a long time now. I mean, the way he was able to place the football, you did not see a lot of, Cal wide receivers running open, busted coverages. Guys were covered, and he just found ways to throw back shoulder. I mean, the first touchdown pass made no sense, Mike. I mean, everybody's covered. He's running for his life. The tight end is covered, and somehow he, takes a step and throws like a rope back shoulder. It was so wild, rolling to his left. I mean, I don't even know if you're Trent. Like, what do you even say to the kid that's covering him? Like, I don't know what to tell you, man. Like, that guy's on scholarship too, I guess. So, you know, I think this weekend it's vital that Oregon State gets the running game going. I really like what I saw out of Malik Murphy. That dude has got a hose now. Mm-hmm. I mean, he can. There's no throw he can't make. I can't think of a guy, at least in recent memory, who could make those kind of throws. And you can go to some of the NFL guys that have come out of Oregon State. The last guy that I can remember maybe having an arm like that is Matt Moore, mm-hmm. In terms of the kind of arm strength that he has, where he just flicks the ball and it's on a line.
Yeah.
So I just think if Oregon State can get the run game going, they've got to find a way to stretch. I mean, this is now going on year two mm-hmm. of – you know, Trent Walker just hitting digs to, you know, in the passing game. They got to find some guys that could take the top off. And it's so unfortunate that Darius Clemens has gotten hurt, mm-hmm. You know, because he was a guy who could do it. If they can figure that out, I think it's going to be a good day for the Beavs.
Nigel Burton joining us. Nigel, you mentioned that first touchdown that JKS threw to Mason Minnie, the tight end. Good play on both their parts. What about the second one as an example of maybe what a true freshman in Trey Glasper trying to cover Tron Grizzell man-to-man down the right sideline? And again, a great throw, and Trey was not in bad position. But Trent Bray talked about we need to be a little better on the ball itself, but the coverage itself was pretty good on that throw too, wasn't it? And what did you make of that second touchdown?
Yeah, I remember when I was coaching for 5 years at Oregon State, and the question I constantly got was, how come the DBs don't look for the football?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I was like, listen, if they were that good at checking the ball, they'd be playing receiver. So let's just start with that. If a guy is what's called out of phase, right, where a guy is not running stride for stride, he got beat and he's chasing a guy down, that's when you teach a guy not to look for the ball because it's really physics or physiology, right, or kinesiology. One of those ologies. It's one of them ologies. And when you're running full speed, if you then have to concentrate on a small point, which the football is up in the air, you physically have to slow down. And that's what allows the DB to get back into phase. That wasn't the case on that throw. And I just think he just turned into the receiver versus doing the old look and lean. And I think had he done that, he would have been in great shape. And you're right. A lot of that comes with experience, age. Again, I coached the worst defense, pass defense in the history of Oregon State football 1 year. And 2 years later, they were the best secondary in the country.
Right.
So a lot of things just have to come from lessons learned and go from there.
But did you see then, in saying that, and I appreciate you saying it, I thought both Jahleel Tucker and Trey Glasper later made good plays driving back to the ball. Didn't they? Did they show some true skills, even the true freshman kid, number 19, Glasper, in that respect?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But again, you were just, you were dealing with a guy who has, you know, and all these guys with their stars, Mike, I mean, it drives me nuts. I mean, some of the best players I coached at Oregon State, Nevada, Portland State, were no-star guys. Some of the worst guys I had coached were guys that had four stars, you know. But sometimes you get a guy like J.K., he lived up to the billing. I mean, his accuracy was insane mm-hmm. for any age of a kid, let alone a true freshman. I mean, I'm thinking of the throw to Mark Hamper in the corner of the end zone. That, again, made no sense. I mean, Mark had to twist his body in a way. I've known that kid since he was mm-hmm. a grade school kid in West Lynn. That he hurt himself. I mean, it was just one of those things. Sorry, man, my dog is about to go nuts. His arch enemy, the postman, just showed up.
That's a bad time, yeah.
And it is. Hey, get away. It's just, you know, again, I think those guys will get better. I don't mm-hmm. think they're going to be dealing, you know, you know, EJ, the quarterback at Fresno State, EJ Warner, Kurt Warner's kid, is a really solid talent. Good kid. He'll get in the camp somewhere. He may hang around as a backup quarterback in the NFL. He is not making throws like that.
So
yeah,
Beaver fans can relax on that one.
Hey, and speaking, you use the word relax. I mean, we all, everybody everywhere, you know, in Chapel Hill, in Austin, you know, wherever, people overreact every day to everything that happened in that first game. Do you sense Beaver Nation's done a little of that because of the nature of the loss or whatever? I'm glad to hear you say that you liked Malik Murphy and the arm strength and what is possible for him, rather than say, oh my gosh, they're in trouble there. You know what I mean? There's an overreaction. Is there not an element in almost any time you lose a football game or even win one?
Yeah. In Corvallis, everybody calm down. If you live in Chapel Hill, yeah, I go ahead and hit whatever panic button you want to do there. Come on, man. When the announcers are bringing their dogs into the booth and putting headsets on the dog, I mean, that's you've run out of all material at that point. As a ball coach, you watch, and what I'm looking for is how does a guy react when things are not going well? Does he show the mobility, the arm strength, the arm talent, the accuracy that we know is there? I saw all those things out of Malik Murphy. In terms of Texas, Arch Manning, I think he had an off day. I would actually be panicked if it wasn't for the throw he had in the fourth quarter along the sideline, along the Texas sideline, where he hit the hole shot in cover two about 35 yards down the field. There's about 10 quarterbacks in the NFL that can make that throw. The problem was he ran some easy boots that, my son in seventh grade could have thrown, and he threw those into the dirt.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's a little different. But, no, I think Malik Murphy – again, I think the biggest issue is every decent secondary is going to squat on every single route that Oregon State's going to run until they find somebody who can run past them and scare them deep. And there was about 2 or 3 years ago when, they had Bolden. And, they had a 4x1 track team, and I think that's why you saw so much success. Last year, I think they struggled because they didn't. They didn't have anybody that would scare you deep. They didn't have anybody who... Trent Walker was really kind of by himself until Darius got healthy.
Yeah.
And when he did,
yeah,
against Boise State, you saw him go to work. So they got to find that. And I think that'll really help the pass game. And then obviously having a consistent run game. The moment you do some play action, linebackers have to show up. Now that's when Trent and a lot of those guys can really do some damage and get behind people. So I think it'll be good. It'll be okay, and hopefully it gets fixed this weekend.
Boy, you mentioned when you talked about the track guys, the one thing, though, that's a little – if you had Malik Murphy, and with no disrespect to the previous quarterback in Cruz, I mean, when Jonathan won 10 in 2022, I thought he did so. He didn't have Malik Murphy throwing that. I mean, then you put Malik with those guys in that year, you're looking at something really profound, I would think, Nigel.
Yeah, if the ball bounces your way, you might be talking about being in the top four.
Right.
I mean, that was – yeah. So, it's interesting how it all kind of shakes out and putting a team together. But, no, he's an elite talent, and it was pretty evident on Saturday. And if the fans didn't see that, then, no offense, they probably just don't know ball very well. And, he was under pressure and things just didn't look smooth. Hopefully they're able to protect and do some things so he can really show that talent that he has.
Do you think Trent's defense, if indeed what Matt Entsch showed in the second half against Georgia Southern, almost exclusively running the football to a 29-0 shutout of Georgia Southern after trailing at halftime and just running it in a variety of ways, is Trent's defense, do you think, this year with its personnel and the way Trent attacks, ready to deal with that kind of approach?
Yeah, I think I think the jury's still out a little bit. I want to see a little bit more. I thought, I think that, it's just going to be interesting. I think the biggest issue that Oregon State's defense has right now is they're still not getting pressure on the quarterback. So in those moments where everybody in the stadium knows they're going to throw the football, it's 3rd and 7, they still weren't able to get pressure on JKS. He was able to sit back, pat the football. And then when the secondary did a nice job in covering, he was able to run for first downs and had, obviously right before the second or before the first half ended, that long run that set up a field goal. So those are the things that, I think I really like their back end talent. We'll see how the front does. They've got to find a way to get pressure. And ultimately, you got to find a way to get pressure without sacrificing guys in the back seven and blitzing. Most teams in America make their biggest jumps from week 1 to week 2.
And so we'll see if the Beavers do.
Do you like, you talk about knowing Mark Hamper, the kid out of West Lynn. It was, you know, I hated to see it against the Beavers, but glad for a kid like that. You know, I like a local kid making good. What do you make of Dexter Foster and an upside and talent level? And have you known him a long time too?
You know, it's funny. I actually don't know Dexter that well. You know, but, you know, I've always felt as though, you know, Oregon high school football at one point was over-recruited when I first got here into the state in the early 2000s. And now I just think the talent level has just really, I think with the way that 7-on-7 has really caught on, I just really feel like Oregon high school football is now kind of under-recruited. Mm-hmm. And then you throw in the transfer portal, and it's just gotten crushed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of really good players. And you can see, you know, again, from, you know, the Darius Clemens and the Mark Hampers, and, you know, you can go kind of down the list. I mean, you know, I coached a couple kids now who are walk-ons at Oregon State who, you know, if they're not on scholarship yet, they will be.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really is cool to see these guys, you know, especially when they stay home. But if they, you know, go to other places, you know, I don't know why I'm spacing on his first name, King, who's a Central Catholic kid who's also on that Cal team and traveled.
Yeah.
So,
Jordan,
you know, it's just,
yeah.
It is. It's very, mm-hmm. Yeah, Jordan King. His dad, Cliff, is going to be really mad at me for stumbling over Jordan King.
That's all right.
Yeah, my Jordan gifts are going to be gone from Nike and Jordan probably this Christmas. But anyway, it is. It's really cool seeing those guys go. And I always kind of believed because we aren't Texas, because we aren't Florida, kids aren't playing year-round, they're playing other sports,
mm-hmm.
The upside of Oregon high school football players is just massive because when they get to college, they can actually focus. When, for the most part, we're doing other stuff because the weather doesn't allow you to stay outside all day and night. And so, it's really cool seeing these guys really, you know, take off during their college careers.
And we hope, perhaps, too, with respect to Malik and options in the pass game, a young kid, a kind of a phenom story out of Crook County High School in Prineville, number 14, Nigel Eddie Freehoff, has the tools physically. You know, whether you know, that's a tough position to learn, and he hasn't been playing football that long, but I'm kind of expecting big things from Eddie, if not Saturday, if not even this year going forward. Did you know anything about him? Sort of, again, an under-recruited guy, it appears, just looking at him physically.
You know, I mean, it's the story of so many guys, you know, through the history of, you know, not just the state of Oregon and obviously in Prineville, but obviously, you know, just Oregon State guys, guys who are overlooked for whatever reason. And, you know, and then they get the opportunity, they grow into the position. I mean, you know, I heard an interview with Mike Hass the other day here locally, and somehow I think I got thrown under the bus, Mike. So me and Hass are gonna. He's like, yeah, you know, Nigel Burton started chewing out his DBs, saying, "How are you gonna let this?" He goes, "I think he called me a white kid," and I was like, "Yeah, I did. You were there. I don't know why this has to be like, you know, this thing, but whatever."
Yeah.
But you know, it's just one of those things where it's funny that, you know, you got these guys. I mean, Mike scored 7 touchdowns in a high school championship game and got overlooked. Like, how do you do that?
Right.
So, you know, again, I just think he's just the continuation of a story that we've just seen over and over again and has really boded well for the Beavs over the years.
Hey, last thing, Nigel, we appreciate your time. Nigel will be working with Ted Robinson and Ryan Leaf on the CW Saturday, Reser Stadium at 12:30. You mentioned your 5 years with the Beavers. When I think about those 5 and then the ensuing several thereafter too, but you guys, the development of players was beautiful to watch. And as you talked about the secondary in 05 becoming the best in the league, in the country, in fact, over the next couple of years. Is that kind of development still possible in the era we're in, Nigel? That's what worries me a little bit.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, is it possible? Yes. Is it as frequent? Absolutely not. Because I think, you know, I mean, I'm dealing with my own kid right now. You know, there at the University of Washington, where, you know, he's developing, he's doing what he needs to do to grow. And, you know, there's just people around, they're like, well, you know, I mean, if he transfers, I'm just like, dude, what? Yeah. You know how many guys play as freshmen and redshirt freshmen? There's not many. I mean, there's the anomalies, but it's just this kind of pay me now, I'll do the work later kind of attitude that's kind of pervasive. And so, you know, I think what Trent is building and who Trent's always been as not just a player and a coach, but as a person, I think really lends well to getting guys, the right guys in the program who understand, hey, we'll help you get to where you want to go. And hopefully where you want to go is not Ohio State. Mm-hmm. Where you want to go is the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And if where you want to go is the NFL, and be a good person and be a good member of society, then this is a good place for you to do that. And you don't have to go anywhere. And so I think those stories still exist, and we're seeing them. I'm with you. I'd like to see them happen more. It does. It takes time and patience. And I don't think, you know, I'll leave you with this, Mike. I remember listening to Bobby Bowden. This was about 25 years ago. And people asked him, you know, hey, you know, you coach kids in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. What's the difference between kids now and kids back in the 50s and 60s? And you know what he said?
No.
Nothing. There's no difference. They're the same.
Yeah.
He said the difference is the parents. The difference is the street agents. The difference is all the people now who are kind of using that kid or, you know, whatever to whatever means. You know, it's just that's the difference. Mm-hmm. And so that mm-hmm. plays in these kids' heads, and they make decisions that aren't good for them, you know, long term. And so, I think kids are still kids. And if you can, you know, really get them to understand you care about what they do off the field more than on the field, mm-hmm. and you build that kind of program that I think Trent's building, I think it'll all work itself out.
Nigel, thank you so much again for your time. As always, we look forward to seeing you back in your old stomping ground Saturday at Reser. Thanks for making time for us, Nigel. We appreciate it.
Mike, stop it. You know you're my guy, man. Anytime.
I'll talk to you
soon, and go Beavs.
Thanks, Nigel. That's Nigel with the Go Beavs, a little bit along the lines of Petros earlier. Let's close. Boy, he did have some developmental teams, Johnny. Remember those groups, 03, 07? He was a cornerbacks coach.
Yeah.
And in 05, it was one of those moments where Mike Riley says to Banker, put somebody else in at Louisville.
Because you said, is anybody going to cover guy?
That was in 03. No, that was the first year. And Nigel and I've talked about it. Nigel snapped his head over when the guy. Anyway, you know, we got over that. But in 05, it was that infamous moment where Coach Riley has said to Banker on the sideline, put somebody else in at corner. With Brian Brom, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, I mean, it was not a good day. Those same guys went. The guys they put in and developed went to the NFL.
Right, the emergence of those guys.
Great stories.
Yeah.
And Nigel says it's still possible, and maybe in the day and age, insanity will keep, the Beavers keep going about their methods and Trent's ways of building a culture and convincing, but also the young people understanding, yeah, there's more influences and outside. That's what he said, the difference is, than ever before. And maybe they're susceptible to those influences and thus jump and move on, take this paycheck here with. It's hard to argue against that.
Right,
I get it.
Right.
But maybe the argument against it is, well, here's what we can do here and develop you over the next 3, 4, 5 years of your life. 5 years now should be automatic, said the player.
Right,
so,
right.
And with the league morphing more into, with college football more professionally oriented, maybe you got, you know, 5 years of pro ball and college ball, almost the minor leagues before you move on to the next
level. Right.
I've
got some breaking news when we come back.
Okay, let's take a break, wrap up the show for today. Now, tomorrow, we are excited to be at Citizens Bank. Free slice of pizza. American Dream Pizza will be there to feed us. The first 25 people who stop by each hour tomorrow at Citizens Bank downtown Corvallis, 234 Southwest 3rd Street. We pay you to come. A $1 collectible coin. So everybody, the first 25 each hour will get that. We'll give away football tickets and other prizes tomorrow.
All right, welcome back. We're going to wrap things up here in just 2 minutes or so. Again, at Citizens Bank tomorrow. Looking forward to being amongst you and having a little party before Saturday's football game. Some breaking news. Thanks to Tyler for letting me in on this, and then I went and found it on Yahoo.com. Ross Dellinger got it. He didn't write this article, but he got the information. That's where the
good
credit goes.
Reporter.
NCAA Football Oversight Committee voted today to support a single transfer portal in January, specifically January 2nd. the administrative committee, the NCAA administrative committee, because that was an emergency vote, needs to formally adopt the change by October 1st of this year, so the end of this month, for it to be effective this year.
Mm-hmm.
And one has to assume and hope that they will. And if they did, that means that all of those players that transferred
prior
or put themselves
games,
in the portal
right.
and took themselves out of bowl games, that'll fix that problem. The story says that all but three bowl games, I'm not sure about playoffs, would be affected by this.
Would be covered,
would be covered by that.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So for most schools, that is great news. It's kind of the fix, if you will. Well, let's just say a part of and a first step towards fixing all of these issues.
It is interesting news, that's for sure.
Because how many players that we hear about, I mean, whole teams, Washington State, they were nothing like the whole team.
Yeah, like the Beavers going to the Sun Bowl and playing Notre Dame.
Right.
And after all of
the end of that 10-win season.
Yeah.
Washington State with John Mateer last year. Mateer, by the way, 392 yards of offense. Someone said he's the leading Heisman candidate.
Yeah, we should just give it to him now. Hey, we're not overreacting at all. Now, I really enjoyed what Nigel had to say. Now, tomorrow, we will be at, as John said, Citizens Bank. We hope you'll join us. That's at 234 Southwest 3rd between 11 and 1. We may have a guest from Fresno State to talk a little bit about their future in the Pac-12 and what that portends, but we look forward most of all seeing you tomorrow. Thank you.